the Rebbe's wife, the previous Rebbe's daughter, which is how the Rebbe referred to her in public, was born in 1901 in Babanovich, which is a village in Russia near Lubavitch. And for the vast majority of the Chabad Lubavitch worldwide movement, she was an unknown person. It was a choice that she made. And she did not want to be referred to as a Rebbetzin. She called herself Mrs. Schneerson from President Street, because in Crown Heights there were other Schneerson families, just to identify which Schneerson. She never wanted for her position as the Rebbe's wife to be somehow used to her benefit. So as the movement grew, she became more and more insulated. She never davened in 770. In the earlier years, she would daven in a shul that was next door to her, that belonged to another Hasidic group. I forgot which Hasid. Crown Heights used to be like the Beverly Hills of Brooklyn. Crown Heights was the neighborhood where all of the people that made it, so to say, went to move. All of that changed in the 60s, when everyone moved out other than Lubavitch. When the Rebbe insisted that once Jews live in a location, even if the quality of life gets hurt, that we're not allowed to ethically leave, run away. Because who ends up leaving are the people that are wealthier. The vulnerable people, the people that are poor, or the elderly people that cannot, they are the ones that stay behind, and it gets even more dangerous for them. So that's a principle that the Rebbe lived, and Crown Heights now is known to be a Lubavitch neighborhood, which is true. But Lubavitch then was a very chasheve. It was like Beverly Hills, and all types of Jews lived over there. Other Hasidic Rebbes lived there. The Rebbetzin Davin next door to her home was a shtiebel from a Rebbe. That Rebbe passed away, or that Rebbe moved to Borough Park, and a new Rebbe moved in over there, and she went there once, and she was given a little bit of kavod, and she never came back. She never davened in public at all.
Wow.
Most people that lived in Crown Heights would not recognize her. I mean, even if they saw her, they would not know that it's her.
So she didn't invite people to her home?
She did not invite people to her home. I know that in the earlier years, when I say the earlier years, the Rebbe became a Rebbe in 1951. The Rebbe on occasion would invite people to his home. He would invite people. She never invited people to home for a Shabbos meal. She did invite people to her home. I'll get to that. And the people that the Rebbe invited were afraid to go. It was very
awkward.
Very awkward for them. And all of them regretted it. I can tell you that my father got invited by the Rebbe to come for Cholent. And he never forgave himself that he didn't do it. It was after Fabrengen. He saw my father. He was very young. He looked even younger. And the Rebbe told him, come for Cholent. And I think he told the Rebbe, I'm afraid. He was honest. He's like, I'm going to go visit with the Rebbe. And he didn't go. Okay, all right, if, okay. The Rebbetzin had a very small group of friends. And yes, she would invite them to her home. But that was not Shabbos. That was never when the Rebbe was there. And even the people that were invited in her home, if beyond her knowledge she would be informed that the Rebbe is coming, she would right away tell the guests that she would call the Rebbe my man, that her man is coming.
Oh.
And
oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I
do. Yeah.
But why?
I don't know. I'm just sharing that. She was a mystery in Lubavitch.
It loses something in the translation.
But in
people.
Yiddish,
maybe it does.
There's a different connotation in Yiddish than in English.
Ella.
I don't know.
We have waters on the table.
I even think she used that expression in English. Yeah.
One
second. Okay.
About her referring to my mom, and the Rebbe heard her and felt very
proud.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think she used that expression in English as well. people out of reverence and out of knowledge that she did not want to have any type of spotlight, people, to respect that, stayed away from the Rebbe's house. And many people would not even walk on that street to give them the privacy that the Rebbetzin wanted. And the big shift, it was huge. It was something that no one was ready for, which is that when the Rebbetzin passed away, the Rebbetzin passed away on the 22nd of Shvat of 19 of Tavshin Mem Ches. That was February 10th of 1988. It was a Tuesday night. The Rebbetzin, she was almost 87. She had a medical chart, like all of us beyond 40. There was no horrible thing that was happening. There was a concern, whatever the concern was. There was a meeting in their home with the Rebbe, with Rabbi Krinsky and two doctors to discuss what would be the sensible step. The question was, should she go to the hospital? Should she not go to the hospital? And there was a decision made that she should go to the hospital. The Rebbe wanted to go, and she insisted that the Rebbe should not come along. Not to make the Rebbe concerned, or she was the one that was downplaying whatever that was happening with her. And when she got to the hospital, she requested for a cup of water. We spoke about this, I think, in last woman's gathering. For some reason, three Lubavitcher Rebbetzins, right before the passing, they asked for a cup of water. She made a bracha. She gave Rabbi Krinsky a blessing, and she passed away. She passed away Tuesday night. And the Rebbe was informed about it right away. 7 o'clock in the morning in Crown Heights, the alarm that they have, like many religious communities, have a big alarm that they may go off before Shabbos. They activate before Shabbos. The Shabbos alarm went off 7 in the morning. People had no idea what that is. And there was a levaya at 12 o'clock. On Wednesday, the Rebbetzin passed away Tuesday night. On Wednesday noon,
so fast.
Yeah, a person ideally should be buried as soon as possible. And I had the merit to be there. No one ever saw the Rebbe broken the way he was during that period. If you would look at a picture of him, which did not capture his emotion, you would cry. The Rebbe was unable to walk. That means his emotional state was not well. And they announced that they're going to walk the Rebbetzin from her home, President between, I think, New York and Brooklyn, and they're going to go to Kingston. They're going to make a left on Kingston, whoever knows Crown Heights, and they're going to go in front of 770. Before they reach Kingston Avenue, the Rebbe turned to Rabbi Groner, and he asked for his car. The Rebbe, and people saw the Rebbe was unable to walk. When the Rebbe's mother passed away in 1964, Rebbetzin Chana, there was such a disorganized scene at the burial site, because many people to give honor went, so many people were like over everyone else, that the Rebbe got very irritated by his mother's burial. So it was already a given, and people asked that no one should go to the cemetery, even though many people went. But instead of there being thousands of people, and it would have been chaos, there were a few hundred people in respect of leaving the scene more organized. In Lubavitch, we don't give eulogies by a burial. Everyone gives eulogies. The whole shiv is eulogies. When people say in Lubavitch you don't give eulogies, that's not a correct statement. We don't give a eulogy at the burial, and no eulogy was given there. The Rebbe came back from the cemetery. The Rebbe was very organized. The Rebbe would daven mincha 3:15 every weekday. And the Rebbe said that mincha, he's going to daven in his home. And they opened up the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin's home for mincha. And after mincha, the Rebbe sat down right next to his shtender, and he's sitting shiva. And I would say for 99% of Lubavitch, that was the first time that people walked into that home. I know many people that felt that they are intruding in private space, and they did not go there for the whole shiva. And they were convinced that this is just for the week. No one knew that everything changed. The Rebbe moved the Aron Kodesh into what was the biggest room in his house, living room or the dining room, and he davened three times a day there. He davened for the Amid. He sat Shiva right there. The Rebbe sat Shiva with his talis and tefillin. And the Rebbe sat for as long as people would come and offer him words of condolences. It was very awkward for a chassid, for a bacher, to go by the Rebbe when the Rebbe is sitting on a low stool with his talis and tefillin, looking very human, really wanting. And we ran by, quickly saying the words of condolences. It was very uncomfortable. But the people with seichel, the people that were mature, spoke to the Rebbe. Spoke to the Rebbe. You know, there was a tradition amongst the Rebbes, and it's good to know that there's a minig amongst all Hasidic dynasties. That means that this is some mystical idea, that when you go and offer words of condolences to a person who's sitting Shiva, if you are to converse, two questions are asked. How old was the person who passed away, and from what did they pass away? And there was a Stalin Rebbe that was, I think, 30 years old, a young man, a very young Rebbe. He was born a Rebbe. That dynasty, they have a certain deformity with their fingers. And the Rebbe before him, who by on his deathbed, there was no successors, but some of his kids or some of his daughter-in-laws were pregnant, he says the one that will be born with the deformity that he has will be the Rebbe. So that was, like I said, he's before his bris, he was born, he is the stolen Rebbe. He walked by the Rebbe, and we didn't know then. And he asked the Rebbe, how old was she? You have recordings in Yiddish. And the Rebbe says that we don't count. First thing, mitzaylnisht. And then he said that if this coming Chaf Hei Adar, which is the Rebbetzin's birthday, she would turn 87. She was born in year 1901. She passed away in 1988. From what did she pass away? And the Rebbe began to cry. You can hear this. And people were upset at him. He made the Rebbe cry. And he said, they told him, why are you asking these questions? He said, that's the minig. Then we found out that every time the Rebbe went to be Menachem Aval, he always asked these two questions. And it's good for us to know that. And the Rebbe, after he finished crying, the Rebbe said that by tzaddikim, that's what he said, the expression that he used was passing. There's no passing. There was an elevation. And she was elevated from an inyan pnimi, for a spiritual reason. And there are many beautiful interactions that he had with people that came to be Menachem Aval. Shabbos, we're not allowed to externalize mourning. The Rebbe went to shul. He was his usual self. You could not see on him that he was in mourning. During the week, he was broken. And Motzei Shabbos, in 770, he took off his shoes and he sat next to the shtender, and which is what many people in mourning do. They go to shul on Shabbos, and then and all of the bachrim that felt that it's not correct to intrude in the Rebbe's private space, that's when they were Menachem Aval the Rebbe. The Rebbe would sit for 3 hours when people would walk by. People would walk by quick. And then you had people, you know, the dignitaries would speak to him. The normal people would speak to him. The Hasidim ran by. They offered him words of condolences. And everyone was convinced that after Shiva, the house is locked. The Rebbe, from then until today, the Rebbe's house became a shul. And that was a big thing. And at the end of Shiva in Lubavitch, and I'm sure in many other communities, I know by the Sfardim here, or maybe by the Persians, they make a big meal the last night of Shiva. Right? You know what I'm talking?
Yes.
So by in Lubavitch, we make the big thing. We make a l'chaim fabrengen after Shiva. So when they finish Shiva, the Rebbe told the Gabbai, it was Pinson, to announce that there'll be a fabrengen. Not that there should be a fabrengen. So he announced in 770 there'll be a fabrengen. The Rebbe turned to him and the Rebbe says, "Who? Here in her home there'll be a fabrengen." So the whole Lubavitch came to the Rebbetzin's home for a fabrengen. No one fit over there. It was chaos. The Rebbe had an office in his home, always, forever. No one knows the Rebbe's upstairs, but upstairs, one room is designated as his office, and the Rebbe basically moved into his office. There was a desk outside his door. When the Rebbetzin was alive, there were times that the Rebbe went home. Even though he went home, but once he was home, his secretary was his wife. Whoever needed something, if there was an urgency, they would call up the Rebbetzin. The Rebbetzin always picked up at the first ring, someone told me. Anytime you would call that home, she would pick up the phone. And if you needed something from the Rebbe, she would be the secretary. When she passed away, per the Rebbe's request, they put a table outside his office door, and he asked for no one to knock on his door. And all of the requests were put on the table. And every now and then, the door would open. People would see the Rebbe's hand taking the notes. And at some point later, everything would be answered on the notes and whoever was in charge. And there was a rotation of Bachrim that were helping out because this was 24/7. The Rebbe would come to 770 for Shabbos. The Rebbe would go home. There would be a lot of home, a lot of 770, a lot of that. This is 1988. I know that we were lucky. We got married in 1991. In 1990, the Rebbe was home half of the time. I'm saying that because when you got married, if the Rebbe was in 770, all of the chuppas were not placed where they are placed right now, in the spacious courtyard that's as the size of this room. It was in the narrow walkway. People got married to be right outside the Rebbe's office, even though the Rebbe did not physically go to chuppas anymore, but the Rebbe never left his office during a chuppah. So we were also mindful. They didn't let you make the time of the chuppah when he would go to shul, which was for mincha or for maitiv, but he would be there, which was a great merit, and unless he went to the oil. So that's a little bit about it. I want to just speak about, you can Google right now and you can see the Rebbe saying his first Kaddish. And I want to describe.
It's on YouTube?
It's everywhere. You can see. Any video that they made of the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin, they're gonna show you the emotion. It was like really, the pain was something that Rebbe was unable to conceal, of him saying Kaddish. And I want to say something very simple, but something very important, especially like we mentioned that right now, unfortunately, it looks like we are getting on Chav Bei Shvat the remains of the Bibas family and of little infants. And how is one to react to that? And one way would be to toughen up. And the right way and the correct way, and I think the only way, and this is not only for Fruma people, this is universal, is to completely surrender to God. There was a bachur that died in yeshiva, when I was in yeshiva. And they asked the Rebbe, what should we tell his mother? It was a tragedy. It was from one night to the next morning, he didn't wake up. And the Rebbe responded, I don't know what one tells a mother. I don't know. The knowing of how to deal with this, the knowing means I feel like I'm in control of it. I know what to do. I know what to say. It's not true. We don't have that power. And even if a person faced tragedy that they were able to manage, but God set up everyone's life in a way that there are moments in all of our lives in which we face something that is bigger than us. And the only way to go through it is not by becoming stronger than it, but is to surrender to it. And when I say surrender to it, this is 101 Judaism, is that we believe, the problem is it's only a belief, we believe that God is running the world. And we say it, and we say it, and we say it, and then it's tested. And then things appear, that this is not God running the world, this is evil people being supported by way too many people are perpetrating horrible things for which they will be accountable for by God. But that's them. We, who are in the receiving end of it, we believe and we have to surrender. And if we won't surrender, we won't survive. That God is running the world. And this was destined to happen for reasons that we will never understand. But it's not hefker. It's not an accident. And it's not a punishment. It's we don't know. It's God. We don't know God. And this is God's doing. And if you think about Kaddish, what is Kaddish? To see a person, the Rebbe was married for 6 decades, for 60 years. The Rebbe had no children. The Rebbe did not have any friends at that point of his life. He was an elder. That was his friend. That was his companion. That was his person. He had no one else. And the way a Jew deals with overwhelming tragedy for the Rebbe, his wife's passing was an overwhelming tragedy. She wasn't sick like she had and she was gonna pass away. It was a sudden passing, in which he did not even say goodbye to her. She did not want him to go. It was like a non-issue. Should you go? She was an elderly woman, so they decided, why not go to the doctor? Why not check it out? And what a Jew does is that he doesn't try to make sense of something, because seichel is too little, is too small to deal with this. This, only God. And God meaning only surrendering to God. And some people have witnessed that either with parents who witnessed it from their parents when they faced real tragedy. And some people never needed to face that. But as Hasidim, we saw the Rebbe. That was the role model. That was something that the pain that he had and what he did was not make sense of it. Was to say Kaddish, was to say that Yizgadal v'Yizgadash Meirab. And crying when he's saying it. He couldn't contain himself. When Rebbetzin Shusterman passed away over here, right, she was 39 years old, I think, 36 years old. And after all of the eulogies that they attempted to give, when it came to it, Rabbi Reichik of blessed memory turned around and he spoke in a language that no one understands, but everyone understood. And he quoted in his Polish Hebrew, a pasuk in Tehillim, in which David HaMelech says that God designates exactly the days and the years for every person to live. And his little line was what people needed to hear. He wasn't speaking about her. He wasn't speaking about how we don't have what to say. He made a declaration, and it came from a tzaddik, that we really believe. And the belief is tested. Of course it's tested. And the pain doesn't mean that we don't believe. It's just it's painful. It's not like if I would only believe, I wouldn't have pain. They never had pain. We have pain. There's no way to avoid this pain. The goal is not to, I'll understand something and I'll overcome it. There's no overcoming this. There's mamish surrendering to the fact that God is running the world, and this was destined to happen. And to feel the pain. And to feel the pain and to cry. And the sages tell us that when a righteous person is buried and people don't cry for them, it's horrible. It's very telling on the level of where people are at. And it's not like we're looking for an explanation, because we're looking to surrender. Looking for some understanding is mamish the wrong path. So that's number one. And that's a kaddish of a yid. And whether it's a Rebbe, a tzaddik losing his companion for 60 years with no children, whether it's a tragedy, or any tragedy, and people in life face tragedy. And no one gets away from that. No one escapes it. It's just, it's going to happen. And there's many levels of surrendering. And it's not like, oh, I know how to surrender. You can surrender today, and tomorrow morning you're going to wake up, and you're going to be back in square one. It's a constant avoida. Of bittul, let's use the word surrender. That's the way the Rebbe translated bittul. And bittul to God. God as being the master of the world. That's number one. And number two. I want to say another very important point. Because for many people, what will happen tonight, tomorrow in Israel, it's going to reawaken a lot of pain that we all experienced on Simchas Torah last year. And in the pain of last year, there was something very beautiful, not the painful part. And if the pain is getting reawakened, so let's reawaken everything, not just the pain. In the year 1913, a Jew by the name of Mendel Bayless was a Lubavitch, from a Lubavitcher family in the Ukraine. He was accused by the Russians of having murdered a Christian child to use that child's blood to make matzah. And as mishuga as it sounds, it's even crazier that this accusation somehow, for some reason, stuck to us for hundreds of years, and tens of thousands of Jews were burnt, and hundreds of thousands of Jews really suffered because of the blood libel. The world that perpetrated these atrocities, they also are continuing with this blood libel. Mamish, it's on Egyptian television, it's on shows to kids that the Jews use Muslim blood to make matzahs. I'm not talking about what's happening now, because no one is being directly affected by it as of yet. But Mendel Bayless, which was a Jew that was tried in the Soviet Union on the accusation of him murdering a Christian child for the Jews to make matzah, was so consequential for millions of Jews. For millions of Jews, because if he would have been found guilty, who knows how many pogroms, hundreds of thousands of Jews could have gotten killed. The whole Jewish world was connected, even in the Western world, everyone was focused on that trial. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, the fifth Chabad Rebbe, Rab Chaim of Brisk, the leading Lithuanian Jew, you understand, every Jewish leader were united and participated in the defense of Mendel Bayless. In Poland, at that time, there was a Jew that was barely 20 years old, that was a brilliant, a genius, an Iluy, by the name of Meir Shapira. He was the one that founded the Daf HaYomi Learning. He founded a yeshiva called Chachmei Lublin. He was an unbelievable mind. And he wrote a letter to the Rav in Moscow. And he offered the following. He says, because during the trial, they were accusing the whole Jewish people that we as Jews, we have to kill Goyim to put their blood on our matzah. And they were going to quote Talmudic passages that if you misquote it, if you quote out of context, it appears that we are very racist. There's a book written now, which is basically the biggest anti-Semitic book, that will point out to you every single Talmudic passage where if you take it, if you just read from here until there, it sounds, there are statements that are crazy or horrible. And I have a video that has already 4.2 million watches, which is horrible, on anti-Semitic websites, in where they know where these gemaras are and they play little clips, and it can be dangerous. And they were attacking Judaism. So Meir Shapiro wrote a letter in which he wrote that if the prosecutor is going to quote the following Talmudic passage as a proof that we are racists, this and that, you should give the answer. And he actually, what he foresaw happened. So the Gemara is speaking in the context of Tuma and how a corpse gives off impurity. And yes, there are laws which differentiate between Jews and Goyim. There's a certain type of impurity that only a Jewish corpse gives off. And it's based on a pasuk in which the word Adam ki yamos ba'oyel, Adam, says Rav Shimon bar Yochai, is ayid. Only Jews are called Adam. Goyim are not called Adam. So that can be understood as a very racist statement. Adam is a human being, that we say only Jews are human, Goyim are not human. So if they're going to make that accusation, so he says, this is what you should respond. And this response was probably the main reason why he was victorious, Mendel Bayless. He was found to be innocent. But what he says, what you should respond to the to the judges or to the prosecutor is that if a Russian would have been accused of murdering a child, who would have been on trial? The whole Russian nation? All of Russian literature? That individual. If an Italian would be found guilty of murder or accused of murder, Italy would not have been on court. The Rome would not be accused. That person. He says, where do you find a nation that one person is accused of murder, but who's on trial? All of the Jewish people. And he went on to say that in Hebrew there are different names for a human being. There are really four names. Adam, who knows? Ish, Gever, and Enosh. And by the other three, other than Adam, that is in the singular, and then you have another word for the plural. Ish, Anoshim. Gever, Gevarim. Adam, what's the plural of Adam? Only Adam. He says, that's what the Talmud is saying. That the Jewish people are so connected that we are the only people that one person is being accused, all the Jews are being accused. Adam. No plural. And history has shown us that whenever there is horrible tragedy, when there's horrible tragedy, the only way through is by really going deep. And when a Jew goes deep, first of all, they have God, not just in mouth, but they really have God. And they are able to surrender to God, and there's no other way. And when you go that deep, we all become one. The type of unity that the Jewish people have does not exist in the rest of the world. If, God forbid, there would have been an attack, let's say, in Brazil, the way it happened on October 7th, the type of solidarity that you have throughout the world of other Brazilians would not be anything close to what happens amongst Jewish people. It doesn't exist. We don't see it, but we are one person. And we're not looking for a silver lining. I'm just stating the fact that when the pain of Simchas Torah comes up, together with the pain comes up a type of unity that we did not experience. Who experienced a type of unity? I'm not just talking about the monies that people gave or the trips that people made, just the feeling, like the connection. Your mom, I felt attacked. You felt attacked. You felt it happened to you. That we are Jews are sitting over here. Who knew the Bibas? No one knew them. And it's affecting people. And it has to affect all of us. There's a beauty to that. And there's something that we should do with that beauty. And what we should do with that beauty is take that unity that we experience when it's brought to the forefront from painful moments. We have to use that unity or express that unity when it comes to joyful moments. Let me tell you what I mean. I'm pashut, that we, all of us here, we are a young community. There's a lot of simchas happening, whether it's a bar mitzvah, whether it's a bas mitzvah, whether it's for the people that are already older, marrying off your children. I think, you know, when you go to someone's simcha, you can be going to someone else's simcha, it's a choice. Or you can experience when you go to someone's simcha that you're going to your simcha. And we are all almost there. And with a little bit of effort, we can get there. So if we have the natural reaction of crying when there's a tragedy that happened to all of us, because we know that this happened to all of us, If it's all of us, let's hold on to the us. There were certain Jews from the older generation. There's a Jew in the city called Rabbi Brod. Rabbi Yosef Brod's father was a Jew by the name of Chatzkel Brod. Chatzkel Brod was a Breslov Chassid who became a Lubavitcher Chassid, who lived in Crown Heights, who went through types of horrors that we don't know of. But people of that era, of that age, European Jews, they went through the worst. He made it his life's mission to go to every single wedding in Crown Heights and to dance his heart out.
Is it Chavis Grandfather? grandfather?
This is Chavi's grandfather. And he was not dancing at someone else's wedding. He felt another Jew, that's me. That's me, because who knows how many Jews he witnessed being murdered because they're Jews. And he somehow held on to that. And he decided, you're kidding? Every in, you know, you live in these big communities, it can be overwhelming. Here in LA, when there's a wedding, it's taka perfect. Because there's a wedding, I don't know, once a month, Baruch Hashem. So even if you are well connected to 10 social circles, how many weddings do you have? When you live in, huh?
I just went to a wedding.
No one goes to a wedding like every day.
Oh, is there a wedding every day? That's a good thing. But in Crown Heights, there's by now probably 3 weddings every day. And for many people, it becomes a little bit...
too much.
Too much, and you lose. But when your kid gets married, it's not too much.
Right.
And if we can hold on to that feeling of unity, that we will all, that we are all, we are in it right now. We're in it. It's going to be a painful day tomorrow. And how, whichever side you're sitting on.
Should we watch it?
That's a personal choice you should make. But you have to do so with a purpose. Some people need to express emotion. And for whatever reason, they keep it bottled inside and they need a stimulant. I'm not saying that's a bad purpose, just to be very aware of why would one subject oneself to. I'm not answering the question. I'm just saying it's important to know why. But whether you're going to watch it, whether you're not going to watch it, that there's a lot of pain going around and there's a lot of anger going around. A lot of anger going around. And on the other side, you have all of the families of the victims of these murderers that are being released, that are saying that they're going to do this again. I'm saying there's a lot of very difficult emotions which have one commonality, and that is that we're mamish together in this. And now we know that. Like Israel and out of Israel is mamish the same. Mamish the same. What they are going around saying here, clearly, they all call the United States the empire, and they are declaring now clearly, after Trump is speaking about moving them out of our country, our Gaza is a Jewish land, they're speaking about committing terrible things over here. And I'm not saying this for people to be frightful. All I want to point out is that because of the painful moment of Galus, there was a tremendous amount of unity. And let's at least also focus on the unity, not to deny the pain and not to ignore it, and to expand the unity. And together with all of the tzar, again, just to say that, like in our kehillah, like, guys, there's a simcha this week, like almost every week. And instead of just becoming habituated to it, yeah, bar mitzvah, I'm not even going to go to shul because too many people.
Right.
No, it's your simcha. If Bibas is your tzad, as it should be, then Zakowski is your kid's bar mitzvah. And the next week is your kid's bar mitzvah, and your kid's bas mitzvah, and your birth, and it's you, it's me, it's us. And that's the message of God, that we should make a l'chaim. It's good, God is calling. We should have good news, Chavra. And we're going to see great miracles happening, that we never lost our faith. We never lost our faith. We're going through this for thousands of years. We're going for thousands of years, and we hold on with our Amuna Shalema, that Mashiach is about to come. And even when things don't look the way they should look, they don't look the way they should look, and we should grapple with it, surrender to God, and by Kaddish we say that may God's name be made great in this world. That happens when the Jewish people are made great. And then we say, and may Mashiach's redemption finally take sprout. This is our ask of God, that the Yatzmach Purkanei V'Karev Mashiachei, and when that will happen, and we believe it's going to happen, and we believe it's going to happen imminently,
amen.
Then as we cry together, we will really rejoice together when we will witness the downfall of these evil people, that we have to witness their downfall, and the lifting up of the honor of God, which is the lifting up of the honor of the Jewish people, and the Beis HaMikdash is going to be built, and things are gonna change for the better. Amen.